This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblet.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm so glad to ask you, what's our topic for this week?
Game of the Year 2023.
Good. But before we start, I do have some programming notes. So our next episode, which will be released on December 17, is going to be our last episode before the winter holiday. So yes, this year again, we are doing a winter holiday. And we will enjoy this nice break and be returning for our first episode of 2024 on January 14th. And I guess once we come back, we'll also talk about the February hiatus, but it's too early. We're still in 2023. But yes, Yannick and I are planning some good time off in the months to come. So that's that. So don't be surprised if you don't hear our voice during the typical holiday season. It's because we are gladly enjoying it. And that's it for the programming note. Yannick, let's go to your main topic.
Anyone who's listened to the podcast for over a year knows what's going on. But if you're new to the podcast, first of all, welcome. We don't say welcome to our new listeners that often. And every year we do a Game of the Year episode. So throughout the year, I play video games, and sometimes good of you plays video games. We'll get into that in a little second.
Don't spoil my section just yet. Come on.
And yeah, so throughout the year, I play video games. For my purposes, a year is October to October, mainly because I want to avoid recency bias towards holiday releases that just came out. Not that I really tend to play games that come out in the same year, but I also want to rule out recency bias for old games that I have played recently as well. So generally, anything that I have started or have made significant progress in after October of 2023 is not going to be in scope for this episode. Once I've played a sizable chunk of these games, generally about 30%, I rate them from 1 to 5, and at the end of the year, I take that list of games and reorder them until I come up with a top 4 and some honorable mentions, and we do a podcast about it. And usually, the Good of You also partakes in this, although in recent years, his participation has become a little bit more spotty, and I guess that's where you take over.
I was quickly looking while we were talking about what was our reoccurrence in this? And I think we are at the 60 or some. It's getting really a pillar of this podcast, which I am slowly but surely, I guess, inviting myself out or something.
Graduating
like
from, yeah.
Yeah, or no, I don't know. I think that the small blurb I'll say here is I did play one game this year, so it's going to be hard to do honorable mention and any form of top N number. So I won't be participating in that, but looking at my notes, I've read that the game I played is also in Yannick's top 4 list. So I'll be chiming into this. If you were to ask me why I didn't play too much video games, I've been thinking about that since for the past few weeks in preparation for this episode, because Yannick kindly reminded me that this episode was coming. And it's hard to me to kind of give a reason. I think your assessment of graduating is kind of funny, but true. I was more or less not in the mood to play games these days. I think I've played a bit of Farming Simulator, and we've talked about it in previous episodes, so I won't bring it up again. I've played a bit of Gran Turismo, which we discussed in the recent episodes. And I've played that game that we'll discuss later. But I felt that, generally speaking, there was not that much game I was interested to play. Nor was I also willing to invest in a new gen console either. And as I mentioned in previous episodes too, I do have a boyfriend that is more of a gamer than I am, and that has bought a bunch of Switch games this year that, to be honest, I haven't played at all. So I make no promises for 2024, and I know it's a bit early to say that. I guess we'll discuss this closer to the end of the show. But yeah, it's sadly for this episode's sake, I don't have a real explanation. Just gonna kind of, it's not something I wanted to spend time on this year, and I guess it reflected on the number of games I've played, which I guess is a good, quote unquote, a good transition, because I would have a one honorable mention in the end. And I think a few weeks ago, so A, I'm already breaking your first rule, which is don't include games from October. In my defense, in the recent years, I was getting better at this. But just for the sake of talking about one game, I did start to play Stardew Valley.
Oh.
Casually. I think I've played maybe twice this month. And I was curious about it, mainly because it is now available for quote-unquote free on Apple Arcade.
Oh, so I didn't know about that.
I've installed it, and I've created my character. And that was one of the rare few moments that this game has been installed since it launched, or since it is now available for Apple Arcade subscriber. And again, during the month of November, I don't know why, at some point I was kind of just not tired, but I was not in the mood to watch a video or just read blog posts on, like, go lose time on social network. Then that's when I was like, oh, let me just go do that. And then I think I lost like 4 hours during my night, during the evening, just to playing that. Yeah, so much so that I think Tony fell asleep next to me while I was kind of like, oh, I'll just cut you 5 more minutes. Give me more 5 more minutes. And then that. So maybe next year I'll talk about this again, making no promises. But all of this is to say that I'm not saying I'm no longer a gamer. It's just I'm in a phase right now where this is something I spend less time on. And I have seriously no problem or qualms regarding that. I've had a few like passion projects or just hobbies that sometimes they, for a few years, they get more time. And it seems that it's a more of a down year for sure in 2023 for video games.
As I've joked in the past, film photography is your game of the year.
Yes, you're correct, that for sure. Photography in general in the past 2-3 years have taken a lot of my hobby time. And like I say, I've taken my time because I've decided to allocate it there. But yeah, I also jokingly made a few comments to you in the past week or so that getting a PS5 is tempting. even Tony is making comments about, oh yeah, we should buy a PS5. And when you say we, it means Luco should buy a PS5.
Of course.
Let's not kid ourselves here. But I'm like, I kind of want one, but I don't want to make it an intervention episode either. But I think the reason I want one these days is more because I want the gadget. Mm-hmm. Itself than that I have games I really, really want to play. Though, again, the Spider-Man 2 seems really neat. I didn't watch too much reviews because I don't want to get too much spoiled, but a lot of the comments I've seen online were like, this is great, especially if you really enjoyed the first game. So I could at least play that and the Miles Morales kind of a 1.5 version that just launched, mm-hmm. that launched at the beginning of the introduction of the PS5 generation.
Yeah, or you could even replay the original with ray tracing if you wanted to, but
that's true. Yeah, that's true, because I still have a base PS4. But yeah, so we shall see. Don't get me wrong. The PS5 was getting tempting. I think I think some of the deals I've seen was even on the quote unquote new version. Mm-hmm. So that was tempting, but I didn't press the add to cart button, even if temptation. So we shall see.
We'll get him next time. right. So I'm going to go into my honorable mentions, and I'm going to start it off with a question. Do you remember what happened last October?
Oh boy. Okay, that's a trick question. I don't know, to be honest.
I bought a Switch.
Fuck. How can I forget about this? That's so true. Yes, you bought a Switch.
Yeah.
After all those years, me teasing you about that.
Yeah, this is the first year that there are going to be any Switch games on... this is going to be the first year that Switch games will be on my list in general, not necessarily the top four, because there are no Switch games on my top four, but...
Oh, okay. Hey, by the way, I am for this exact moment, not that I was not interested in this episode, quite the contrary, but I think my hype level went to 11, just because I forgot that you bought a Switch, and that's the year we were discussing about that.
Yeah, so I'm going to go through some highlights of Switch games that I've played over the last year. I'm not going to mention all of them, because there are shockingly a lot of them. I have bought a lot of Switch games.
Really?
So,
huh.
Yeah. Nice. So first off, I want to comment about Xenoblade Chronicles 2. You've probably heard the hype if you have a Switch. It's a massive open world RPG, and I was pretty interested in the original Xenoblade. The main thing that turns me off with all of these games is that they are 100 hours long minimum, and Xenoblade 2 is not that far, not much less in terms of overall playtime. So I love the combat system much more than the original Xenoblade. There's this mechanic in the game called field spells, which are basically kind of like HMs in Pokemon, except you have to use a gacha mechanic to get like little creatures that contribute points to field spells, and there's like a skill tree, and it's really annoying when your progression is blocked because of needing a specific field spell, and then you have to either gamble for a while until you get the thing that you need, or go do some really boring inane tasks to fill out your skill tree to unlock the thing you need. Aside from that, the game is incredibly impressive, especially for technically impressive on the Switch for the quality of the vistas you get, considering the hardware of the Switch. Of course, sometimes it runs at like 360p in handheld mode because it's a Switch game.
Yeah.
Next up on the list, something that I am surprised that was not on my top four list, because I would have probably guessed that at the start of the year, Fire Emblem Engage. I'm a big Fire Emblem fan. I think I've had one or two Fire Emblem games on my Game of the Year lists over the years. This one didn't quite make it. I think it felt really, really easy for the first two-thirds of the game, and then I hit a massive difficulty wall where I basically just wasn't dealing any damage to anyone anymore. Ooh. And I couldn't tell what I did wrong. At the time, I suspected that I hadn't... So there are a bunch of training mechanics in the hub world that you go back to after each mission that I had completely ignored because I had seen no evidence that I actually needed to engage with them at all. Mm. And the gains that I was seeing online seemed so incremental that they wouldn't really matter over into the... my stats at all. But then I hit this wall, so I was like, oh well, maybe I should have invested in those systems, except now I'm two-thirds of the way through the game, so I'm two-thirds of the game late on incremental gains. So even if I start now, I'm not going to make up that two-thirds of the game that I didn't use those systems. So I just lost interest when I had to examine like what did I fuck up
and what was that in the end.
I still don't know. I haven't gone back. I basically just said, like, I enjoyed my time with this game, but I can't finish it right now, and there were too many other things I wanted to play to go back. Ultimately, like, I've always had a bit of anxiety with regards to where Fire Emblem was going in a Switch world where you can't rely on sprites to draw your units anymore, and it's a lot less readable at a high level. They have to rely on tons of little UI hacks to try and make things more readable, but it makes it more cluttered at the same time. So I'm not sold on high fidelity Fire Emblem, but this is so far the best high fidelity Fire Emblem take that I have seen in the series. So I think if they continue on this trajectory, they might actually improve it to the point that it's playable again, but it's still not in my favorite Fire Emblem games. In fact, it's amongst the lower Fire Emblem games that I've played, which is kind of weird, but I still really like it because Fire Emblem is still, at the end of the day, very good.
Good enough to make it in the honorable mention.
Yeah, I wanted to shout it out anyway because Fire Emblem is always going to be a special thing. It's, you don't get those games very often, and it's a treat every time it comes out, even if it's not a good Fire Emblem game. Next up, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. It's no Mario Kart Double Dash, which is my favorite, but it's still a very good Mario Kart. I think second place after Double Dash. Double Dash is still the number one, of course. Smash Brothers Ultimate. I can't not shout out this game. This is actually the reason I bought the Switch in the first place. I just was really wanted to play some Smash, and it's been a ton of fun against the CPU. Unfortunately, delay-based netcode, so it's essentially unplayable online, even over Ethernet, which is really annoying, but it's still a good game at the end of the day. Can't not say it. And then my one indie download game that I'm going to shout out is One Step from Eden. This is a game by a friend of a friend of mine.
Huh.
And it is a roguelite take on Mega Man Battle Network. So you basically build a deck of cards that are attacks that your little dude can deal damage to opponents with. It's very complicated. If you're not already familiar with the Mega Man Battle Network thing, I would have to spend the entire episode explaining it to you, and it's very hard to describe with audio, so just trust me and go look it up on the internet. It's a fantastic game. but it's incredibly fast-paced, like ridiculously fast-paced. Like, I play music games and this is too fast for me. It's insanely fast-paced. I play, there are assist settings. I turned the speed all the way down, and the more you play, the lower you can turn the setting, and it's still too fast. It's kind of crazy. I think like I have it at half speed right now, and it's still too fast for me, so it's kind of nuts. The other issue that I have is I would recommend this game on PC, but not on Switch, because on Switch it is a Unity game, and garbage collection pauses can kill your run randomly because it's too fast. So yeah, play it on PC, not on Switch. But great game. So that is the whirlwind tour of Switch stuff that I have for the year. Now I have two other games I want to shout out on PlayStation. So first of all, Destiny 2 The Witch Queen. So this is the 2 years ago expansion. It's absolutely fabulous. It is phenomenal. I played it in the Legendary campaign, which is like the higher difficulty campaign, in co-op with my friend Rai. It is the most compelling campaign that Destiny has ever had, both narratively and its encounter design. Absolutely work of art, which is why it was profoundly disappointing to play Lightfall a couple months after that, and it was awful. But what can you do? So fingers crossed that the final shape next year in June is going to be as good as Witch Queen. I'm hearing the right things come out of Bungie, but they also fired a bunch of the staff, so we'll see. But really, fingers crossed, we need Destiny, the original saga, to end on a good note, and if they can make it as good as Witch Queen, it will be a good note. The second PlayStation honorable mention is Street Fighter VI, and it almost was number 4. This is the kind of return to form that Gran Turismo 7 should have been for Gran Turismo series. Every major complaint about Street Fighter V and the last decade of the fighting game genre as a whole is addressed by this game. The people who are in charge of Street Fighter VI get it. Finally, Street Fighter is playable online with really good rollback netcode. You don't have to worry about it. You can play with basically anyone around the world without problems. It's a masterpiece. I really wish I had had more time to play it this year. I basically played it all the month of the launch this summer, and then played other stuff. But I would love to dump more time into Street Fighter VI. It's really good, and it's super mechanically dense, and I love those kinds of games. So I will probably come back to this in 2024, but I'm very sad I didn't have enough time with it in 2023. So those are my honorable mentions. Do you have any comments before we move on to number 4?
I do. I'm a bit surprised that you have that much Switch game. I guess it's because you mentioned that you won't have any in the top 4. But was your year focused on the Switch? Or it was papered throughout the year, meaning that you had a lot of PC and PS5 games on top of the back catalog of games you wanted to attack on the Switch?
So in, I was saving this for the end, but I'll address it right now, where I have played a lot less games this year in general, and okay, that was kind of intentional. So I was trying to focus on a smaller number of games, and we'll talk later about whether I succeeded with that or not.
Perfect.
I only bought a single PlayStation 1 game, which is really rare for me, and I don't even have any PS1 games on my list this year, which is incredibly rare. For most of the previous years, most of my list was PS1 games.
True.
So this year, I really focused on PS5 and Switch.
I see.
But it's also heavily impacted by the fact that I played about half as many games as I played last year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Dramatically less than usual, yeah.
So, wait. So you're making fun of me because I played one game, and I think last year I played, what, 4, 5? I know you listened to our episode last year's episode recently.
Yeah, you had 3 games last year.
Okay, so like I'm at that like a 66% percentage down, and then you had 50. So see, I'm not that bad.
Yeah, the difference is I can still make a top 4 at the end of the day.
I know, but still, percentage wise, it's still, we're both down around the same level.
I think what's funny is, I think 2 years ago you said, oh, I want to try playing more games since you have the PS2 now and stuff like that and all that stuff. True. And your number has only gone down, and I've been saying I want to play less games, and I actually have been playing less games.
That's fair. Maybe it's because I took your own advice and not mine.
All right, ready for number four?
Yes.
Okay, if I tell you to guess a game that I like that has a number four in the title, what would you guess?
Okay.
You can't say Street Fighter 4.
Right, and it's not a Switch game.
It's not a Switch game.
Right, and I'm not thinking about the PS5 game that you played. Why?
It's not a PS5 game either. It's an Xbox game.
Oh, of course, because I forgot that you had the Xbox Cloud subscription, but not... I told you when you asked, you told me that you bought an Xbox, that all the games you played on the console itself are not included.
True, except I played one game on Xbox One this year before I bought the Xbox Series X.
Oh, it's on Xbox One.
It's Forza Horizon 4.
Oh, you played an original, quote-unquote original Forza, or at least a Xbox original Forza, I should say.
Yeah, I beat Forza Horizon 4 this year. So Forza Horizon 4 released in 2018 on PC, Xbox One, and later ported to Xbox Series X. It's also available for free to Game Pass subscribers, which I am now. It was developed by Playground Games and published by Microsoft Game Studios. I originally started playing this on my brother's Xbox One S back in May. Whenever I would visit my parents, I would just come in and play. Whenever like they had to go get something or whatever, I would just go idle on the Xbox One and play the game. And I had a great time. It's completely different kind of racing game than what I'm used to from the Gran Turismo series, but it's definitely still great. In many ways, Forza Horizon is a game series that's kind of defined by its spectacle and how bold its presentation is. The campaign pretty much always has the same premise where drivers from all over the world gather to the Horizon Festival, which is kind of a combination musical festival and celebration of racing. Shout out to Hospital Records, who does a bunch of really cool drum and bass. They basically provide most of the music for these games, and they even license their music in a streamer-friendly way if you want to stream the game. So I loved them before I knew they were in Forza, but they also rule. Every major chapter of the campaign is punctuated by a bold showcase event, which usually involves some kind of like theatrical driving stunt. Like one of them is racing against the speeding train, or in one of them, I think you use like a hovercraft instead of a car. There's like weird and wacky missions like that all over the place. Like we mentioned on the GT7 episode, this is sort of the game that put roulette rewards on the map. So every so often you'll level up and you'll get a roulette reward, and amongst the rewards you'll have like cosmetic parts for your driver, car horns, which it's really funny. The car horns that you can unlock include like Windows user interface sounds. So you can have like the login sound from Windows XP as your horn. you can get cash or you can just get outright cars. I think I won an AE86 and I sent you a photo of that once. So that was cool. Game is absolutely focused on instant gratification. Like we said on that GT7 episode, the vehicle on the cover art is generally the very first car you will drive within minutes of booting the game. That is intentionally done like that. 90% of the events in the game can be completed with any car you want to choose, because events are actually just track layouts combined with a race type. That's basically all it is defined as. By default, your opponents are randomly selected from online drivatars, which are kind of like player ghosts, and cars are randomly generated around your power level. And if you want to, when you select an event, you can also choose to optionally apply either developer-designed or fan-designed constraints to the event. But at no point you actually have to do so. You can do so if you want to. So if you want to go to like a race and there's like a developer provided pickup truck race, you can enable that, but it doesn't actually change anything to whether you beat it or not, because it's just a checkbox for that race. So it's cool, but it's also optional and it's weird. Forza Horizon is totally about living different fantasies than what we typically seek from a Gran Turismo title, and I think it does that remarkably well. But at the same time, I don't really know how many of these games we realistically need, because the only thing that changes from one Forza Horizon game to another is graphical fidelity, the songs in the soundtrack, and the location of the Horizon Festival. Forza Horizon 4 is my personal favorite in the Forza Horizon series. It takes place in a fantasy version of the United Kingdom. And one of the features that's unique to Forza Horizon 4 is the seasonal system. So the map is playable in all four seasons, winter, spring, summer, autumn. and different events are available in different seasons, and different parts of the map are available in different seasons. For example, the winter map has the entire lake covered in ice, so you can actually ride on it. It's probably not a good idea to do that in real life, but you can do it in the game and it's fine. And once you actually beat the base campaign, there's a lengthy post-game because the current season is set server-side and it rotates every real-life week. And when you do that, you get refreshed events and objectives each cycle. So because of the seasonal system, I think that Forza Horizon 4 is actually the most visually diverse and visually impressive Forza Horizon game, even though it technically wasn't designed to take full advantage of the Xbox Series hardware, just because there are so many colors that you don't see in other things. Like, if you look at Forza Horizon 5, which takes place in Mexico, it mostly just looks orange, no matter where you are on the map, no matter what you're doing, what the weather is, it just looks like orange Mexico. And here, like, every time you play, it'll look a little bit different, and it'll just... There more variety is good for a game like this where you're expected to sort of live in it in your car, and I really like that. Also, Forza Horizon has fucking crazy ideas, man. This is where I need to talk about the Dominator, which is Forza Battle Royale.
What?
Oh yeah, this is awesome. I love this idea. It's completely random, but it's so funny. So everyone starts out spread out across the map in the same crappy low-powered car, okay? You drive around the map, and everywhere you'll find, like, cars parked in different locations. Some of them are faster than your car, some of them are slower than your car. You generally want to upgrade to a faster car. So when you drive up to a car, you can just press a button and swap to the next car. Then, if you drive around and you come across another player, you can press a button to instantly challenge them. What this does is it puts a marker on the map, and the first one who gets there is safe, and the other one is eliminated.
Wow.
The zone mechanic, the circle, right, that closes in as the game goes on, it still shrinks every minute, so anyone who goes outside the zone will eventually die and be eliminated. And after a certain point, it'll be at the final zone shrink. Everyone who's left, there's a pin that's dropped on the map. You have to race there, and the first one who gets there wins.
Ah, that sounds cool.
It's not the most balanced game mode ever. There's a lot of weird ways you can get fucked by the random number generator, but it's still really fun, and it's really wacky. I didn't think this would actually work out, and it's surprisingly fun. So there are weird ideas like this all over the game. This is just one of them, and it's obviously not something you will find in a Gran Turismo game. So if you're looking for something very off the beaten path, and you're looking for something that is still a racing game that is really well executed but just has crazy ideas, this is a great one to check out. I have not purchased any DLC for the game, but I am also particularly interested in checking out the Lego Speed Champions DLC, because it basically gives you a small Lego city that is completely built out of Lego that you can drive Lego cars around in the open world.
Nice.
And do Lego missions in it, and that sounds fucking awesome. So maybe eventually I'll buy that. So yeah, that is number four. Let's move on to number three, and this game was released in 1995 on the Super Nintendo Entertainment System.
Whoa, what a shift.
Yeah, it's Donkey Kong Country 2, Diddy Kong's Quest. You can also get it if you're a Switch Online subscriber, and it's also available on GBA. It was developed by Rare and published by Nintendo. So I don't talk about it very often, but Donkey Kong Country is definitely a staple of my childhood. One year, my parents and my grandparents bought me and my cousin the same kit on the same year. It was a Super Nintendo, Super Mario World, and Donkey Kong Country, and two controllers. It was a pretty sweet kit, even though the N64 was already out at the time. Like, you can have a lot of fun with that, and we did. I had a lot of fun playing through Donkey Kong Country with a next-door friend. Whenever he would visit his grandparents, he'd be next door, and I remember we struggled a lot with the final world and eventually the final boss fight, but we eventually did it. And whenever I would run into a step-cousin during holidays, we would frequently play Donkey Kong Country 3, Dixie Kong's Double Trouble on his Super Nintendo, and that was really cool too. And in more recent years, I've learned to love Crash Bandicoot and how it basically just translates the 2D linear rhythmic platforming of Donkey Kong Country into 3D space. And having played a bunch of Crash games in recent years, it made me want to go play a DKC game again. So now that I have the Switch, I can go to Switch Online and just boot up Donkey Kong Country 2 whenever I want. And since I knew the other two games were pretty good, I was pretty sure I was going to come out the other end happy. And what I didn't know at the time is that Donkey Kong Country 2 is frequently held up as being the best of the series, and also just one of the best platformers, period. So that was a cool thing to learn as I was playing it. One of the things that I've always sort of appreciated about the Donkey Kong Country series that I think a lot of platformers stumble with is level variety. Donkey Kong Country 2 has a bunch of level types that it cycles between to keep things from getting too repetitive. And a bunch of these were in Donkey Kong Country 1 as well, but like underwater levels, minecart levels, vine grappling levels, barrel timing levels, like all of those, yeah, sure, they were in DKC 1. But like DKC 2 has tricky navigation levels where all of the edges are covered in thorns that are really a pain in the ass to play. There's one level type that completely fell flat for me, which are the beehive levels, where you have a honey mechanic that sort of slows down your ability to move around the map. I found these to be complete pace killers whenever they came up. I really didn't like those levels, but otherwise I think all of the levels that were designed for returning level types really understood what was fun and frustrating in DKC 1 and sort of eliminated the frustrating parts and went and optimized for fun. And those were really good. And aside from the honey levels, the new levels were good as well. When you ask people to talk about this game, a lot of people say this game is a particularly hard platformer, and I'm inclined to disagree. But then again, like, I have a lot of experience with the series over the years, so maybe I'm just more used to it than someone who's completely fresh to the Donkey Kong Country series. I only had a hard time on like a handful of levels, and everything else went relatively smoothly, although I can see it being too challenging for younger children to pull off and getting stuck there, which, to be honest, was the case for me with Donkey Kong Country 1. But there's nothing like insurmountable here, or at least I didn't find that it was. And really, the conclusion for this game is, as a busy adult, I really appreciate level-based games like Donkey Kong Country 2 because it's already broken down into bite-sized chunks that I can savor over time. When I was playing this game, I played it at a pace of a level or two a day over the course of 2 months. There are 52 levels in the game. Doing it that way, it's much, much easier to integrate it into a busy lifestyle and not feeling like worried that if you go sit down in front of the TV to play a video game, it'll be a massive time sink like most modern games that aren't broken up into chunks with clear boundaries. I was thinking about Returnal, which is one of the games I've been trying to play recently, but the problem I have with Returnal is there's no game over screen. It just sends me back to my ship, and I'm already ready to go on my next run, but there's no do you want to continue or exit. It's just you're back in the game from the starting checkpoint, and I just don't want that. I want a clear beginning and end so that I can feel like I can turn it off and not have all of the text on screen telling me, hey, go here, go here, go here, do this. And there's so much less of that in modern games. So I think if you play level-based games like this, entertainment and enjoyment can become a contained daily ritual activity instead of a vacuum for whatever free time you have on hand. And I think I enjoyed the game more by taking my time on it, which is certainly a lesson that I'll come back to. And it's something that I've heard from other people over the past few months that is sort of the takeaway of the year. Taking your time on things can be good, which is kind of why I reduced how many games I played.
The fact that it's on on Nintendo Switch Online, like, it is nice because if you're the type of person that has a commute and also is bringing their Switch with them all the time, like, you can more or less treat it as a smartphone game, but not being on the smartphone.
Yeah, and I think the save states also in the Switch Online emulators and stuff like that also make it pretty good for games that have unforgiving save systems. Mm. Like, if you don't want to put up with the bullshit of having to, like, in Donkey Kong Country, I think there's like one save point for each world. So you have to make it like through the first three or four levels before you can actually save and then do the next three or four levels. And I think for some people, like, if they die on the last level before the save point, it's a massive demotivator to have to go through those other levels, especially if you struggled with one of them. I think I'm still from the older generation where I'm like, okay, but now I'm better at the game, so I'm going to go through those levels faster and I'll appreciate it more. But I think like there's a newer generation who has never had to deal with that. And I think for them, the save state feature is really good for that. And even just people who are busy and they could do it, but they just don't want to. They just want to get to the end of the game. Like, that's fine too. I'm not one to judge about that. So yeah, it's really convenient to have it on the Switch Online, and there's at the same time, like, there's so much stuff on Switch Online that you're like, why is Nintendo giving you the access to this for free? They could be making so much more money by charging for it. But at the same time, there's also stuff that you're like, why is this not on Nintendo Switch Online? I can't believe they forgot to put this game on here.
Hey, some stuff is paid, right? Some stuff you have to have the paid subscription to have access to it.
Well, they're both paid subscriptions. It's just a question of how much you pay.
Oh, right. I forgot.
Okay. I have the cheap paid subscription, so I just get NES, Super NES, and original Game Boy. But if you want Genesis, N64, and Game Boy Advance, you have to pay for the bigger one. And they will probably sucker me in with the Game Boy Advance stuff eventually.
Right. And now I forget which version we pay. I know we pay for family member because...
I'm pretty sure you have the big one.
I have to look.
I think I remember you telling me you have the big one.
Yeah, I think I did that for GoldenEye. That got mixed. That wouldn't make a sense, but hey. Again, I haven't played video games recently, so I forgot. And
I completely forgot GoldenEye was on Switch now.
Yes, because you have to pay for the N64 one, so...
I also heard it was a bad port, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I guess if we wanted to, we could link. I think Digital Foundry did a video for this?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I forgot which. I'm looking quickly at the Nintendo Switch Online, and I don't know where to see what my status is, so... But I am ready for number two, yes!
Interesting. You seem excited all of a sudden. Number two is a game that we both played. It is, yes, 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim, developed by VanillaWare, published by Atlus. It was released in 2019 on the PS4 and later ported to Switch, although I think that's the Japanese release date. It was released during the pandemic, and I think a bunch of the lines were recorded in home studios. But it is a combination visual novel and real-time strategy revolving around school kids piloting giant robots, which is a recurring theme on the show. The comment I'm going to make is just trust us, especially if you love sci-fi, go play this one blind and ignore everything else we're going to say in this chapter. But I do have one caveat I need to point out first.
Yeah, before you do so, I found out some of my notes regarding this game. And I'm not sure if you still have this video on end, but you did send me a video that was kind of talking about the game.
Yeah.
Spoiler free, because your introduction to this game to me was, trust me, you'll want to play this game. And I think at that point you had maybe 10, 15 hours in, because I know you were playing through it. So that happened as when I usually play video games these days, is during the holiday break. So I watched the video. I was like, huh, this got me curious.
I can link that video in the show notes. The main thing is I think it spoils too much. So I'm going to...
We're going
to have a brief mechanical spoiler section in a little bit where I'm going to explain it with less spoilers than that.
Okay, then maybe don't link it and we'll trust you.
Oh, I'll link it, but I'll just label it correctly.
Perfect.
So the caveat I want to mention first, if you're thinking about playing this blind, is VanillaWare is led by its lead illustrator, George Kamitani, and this man is horny beyond belief. George Kamitani is a man who knows only two extremes. Either his female character designs go full Attack of the Mommy Milkers, or he goes with juvenile childlike characters, and unsurprisingly, both of them get pretty sexualized throughout his art. To be fair, 13 Sentinels is nowhere as bad as previous VanillaWare games on the horniness scale, but I think you do need to be prepared for it, and I did not prepare to code view for it, and it's perfectly understandable if this is a deal breaker for you, but otherwise this is a fantastic game and you should play it.
I would kind of challenge your statement that you didn't prepare me. I guess throughout a friendship was something that prepared me to...
You knew it was anime bullshit.
Yes, and like again, I watched the video, I've seen some of the stuff, and then the recommendation came from you, so I was kind of like, okay, like, I knew where to put, like, where to categorize it, and I would echo the sentiment that sometimes I'm like, yeah, weird anime bullshit, either take that with a grain of salt, no, or be open-minded about that. Because I had a few moments of like facepalming myself because it's so dumb.
I got several messages from Tony that were like, what are you making my boyfriend play?
Yep.
So we will talk about the game a bit more, but this game is kind of impossible to talk about without spoiling anything, and trying to explain that is also difficult to talk about without spoiling anything. So if you do actually trust us, do not look up anything about this game. Do not tell anyone who has played the game that you are playing this game. Don't tell anyone who is playing the game that you are playing this game. And just go play it, and don't tell anyone you've played it until after you've finished it and seen the credits.
Which, by the way, one of the reasons why, even if you wanted to have a spoilerful section, we cannot do that because I'm one of those person.
Exactly.
I haven't seen the credits. I think I might be like 5 hours away, not that much. Again, since Yannick was always in front of me, it was fun to have a friend where you can talk to about this game, knowing that...
However we could. I'm not sure if we really could, but sure.
What do you mean?
Well, we've not talked about any story details, really, because... Well, you could talk to me about what you were seeing, but I couldn't talk to you about anything.
Right. I'm talking about my perception my perspective here. But you're correct that, yes, because you were in front of me in the story and I didn't finish the game. I was the one saying, oh, that was fun. Oh, wow, that was bad. Oh, my God. Anime bullshit. But, yeah.
So, yeah, if for some reason Blind Faith is not enough to make you check it out, we are going to give a slightly more drawn out explanation of what this game is and why it's impossible to talk about. But if you do trust us, we urge you to skip ahead if you want to go in blind, which you should. There will be a timestamp in the description, and Overcast people, there are going to be chapters. All right, let's get started. 13 Sentinels is two games. It is a visual novel that constantly pulls the rug from under you, and it is a very good semi-real-time strategy game with giant mech combat. Let's start off with a visual novel. After the brief introductory period, you can essentially play through the perspectives of the 13 main characters in almost any order. Each of these 13 characters is witnessing the same events playing out, but their personal understanding of these events is wildly different. And part of why their understanding of these events is wildly different is because they are trying to internally contextualize the events that are happening to them through the lens of real-world science fiction media that they are familiar with, as that is the only frame of reference that they have for what is happening. I think that this is pretty cool because, first of all, it's not something you see very often in media, but it also mimics what the player themselves is going to be doing as they play through all of these different perspectives. We are all, as we're playing this game, sifting through our minds for a science fiction framework that we are familiar with that makes sense of what the fuck is going on. But there is no story that is quite like this anywhere else. You will not guess what's going on. You can try, though. And every time you think you have guessed what's going on, the game will have some massive rug pull revelation that will completely reset your understanding of what the fuck is going on.
And boy, is it addictive. And I say that with I haven't finished the game. I think that if I recall correctly, the main reason I didn't finish the game is because it hit my end of holiday hiatus. I went back to work and I couldn't literally burn evenings and evenings just being in front of the PS4 playing this game because, oh, let me play 15, 20 minutes more because I want to know this part of a story and that part of a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's kind of the problem, right? So importantly, you can play a character's stories in any order, but there isn't really any way to concisely describe to someone what you have and haven't seen from all of the 13 characters' stories. It's very difficult to talk to someone else who's playing the game what you've seen without spoiling things to them. And to some degree, like, there was a risk that you could have done this to me as well, because nothing tells me that if for character A, you're at 75% and I'm at 60%, but I'm technically further in giant quotes in the game than you could still spoil me on like that 15% I haven't seen, because there's no real way to tell you that. And the other issue is, like a lot of video game spoilers, a lot of the rug pull revelations in the game can essentially be condensed to a single sentence, which makes the game incredibly spoilable. Like, I can tell you one sentence and the entire section of the game you're in is ruined. But at the same time, there's kind of an interesting thing where there are so many of these rug pull revelations and there is so much ridiculous shit happening in this game that I can make up a bunch of shit that sounds absolutely ridiculous. And after a certain point of the game, you probably wouldn't actually be able to guess if it was a true spoiler or not. And that's kind of funny. So that's all I had prepared for the visual novel section of the thing, because I really don't want to spoil it any more than that. This is more like this is the pitch to get you sold on playing the game. Right. It is not discussion of the game.
I think the last thing I would add that surprised me is I'm not traditionally a visual novel gamer. And like I mentioned, this got me hooked. Mm-hmm. To the point where, Nick will talk about the other game in the game, mm-hmm. That I ended up, quote unquote, stuck.
Yes.
Because I had... I use the word stuck here, but more that the story, the visual novel part was stuck because to continue in it, I had to go into the second part of the game and do progress there. And that was after playing to the level that I was at. It is something I felt that I kind of wish the game had a bit more guide rails to kind of move you along. It move you along a bit more balanced, because if you're like me and then you get hooked on the story, I ended up progressing more on the story side than on the strategy side.
Mm.
And then I had a big wall where I had to do a bunch of missions on that side.
Yeah.
Which kind of like I was like, let me go through this part so I can go back to the story type of scenario. And I think for me, and we'll discuss it in more detail, but that for me, I don't want to compare both parts, but like I kind of wish though that the strategy part of the game was not too much in my way.
Mm-hmm.
That I end up feeling.
Right. So real-time strategy, let's address it. At any time you could play through another segment of the narrative, you can also just choose to go head off to battle. And those battles are what I call semi-real-time strategy, mainly because the events play out in real-time until you select a unit to give it actions, at which point, while you're in the menu, the game pauses. This, to make a reference that no one will get because I am the only person on the internet talking about this video game, it's reminiscent of Kokido Genso Gun Parade March, which is a PS1 game that I'm making a video about because no one is talking about this game that is incredibly influential on a lot of shit. This game is actually a spiritual successor to Gun Parade March in more ways than one that I cannot detail because it's a giant spoiler. Fans of Gun Parade March, all two of us, love 13 Sentinels. And in fact, I only played this game because I was researching the video for Gun Parade March, and I played this instead of Gun Parade March. Cool. So yeah, there are many upgrade systems to balance, and it's honestly kind of overwhelming because you don't know where you dump your points, but that's just strategy games. We love them. Be very careful, though, if you are overwhelmed by the upgrade systems to... Mm-hmm. If you look up build guides, you may accidentally run into narrative spoilers in the process. I did, but it wasn't a huge deal.
Okay.
But still, I was like, yeah. Which skills do I need? And then the sidebar is just like a bunch of spoilers because it's just a general wiki for the game and there's no delineation between the strategy part and the... But yeah, you learn from your mistakes.
See, I didn't do that. But I got confused into the upgrade mechanism.
Yeah.
So I kind of just wing it. I'm like, I like those skills. And I'm like, I'll just upgrade those skills for all the characters. And that's always bad in a real-time strategy game.
But yeah, I was like, what are the best skills? I will invest my points into the best skills. And then I sort of did that and it went great. But yeah, I also got spoiled in the process.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it went great. I mean, maybe for the strategy part of the game, it went great. But
just make sure just make sure the sidebar is off the side of the screen where you can't see it. The soundtrack to the RTS battles is ridiculously good. The music in this game is absolutely insane, but especially the battle music. I keep listening to it while I work. It is a banger that you will head bop to, even if you're... battle lasts a really long time, you won't get bored of it. Like, that's the best kind of video game music, in my opinion. And as you could have even mentioned, you're going to eventually reach lock points in character stories, which means you either need to specifically see another scene in another character's perspectives to be able to move any further, or reach a given stage in the battle missions to be able to progress any further. And this is interesting because this lock mechanic does give the developer some hard control over how events are revealed to you. So there are certain things that you can't be revealed before a certain point, because otherwise the story would make even less sense than it already does, or too much sense, or whatever. So it's not the Wild West, but it's still pretty risky to talk about it with someone else. And as you could have said, if you're not chipping away at the battle backlog over the course of the game, you will be massively backlogged at the end of the game, and you may lose your motivation partway through, like could have you did. So pace yourself appropriately.
I kind of forgot to boot up the game again and see where I was at. I think the other problem I have now is, even if I was going through, not quickly, but I was trying to go fast, let's put it this way, there are good mechanics to kind of force you to do gold trophies like in Gran Turismo licenses. So that kept me in check. And I guess that's also a worry now that it's been literally a year at this point that I've played the game. Now I'm worried because every time you win, you would get a bonus percentage point, so that the next game you get more points, because I think it will multiply by like 1.1, 1.2, I think it's per 10% every game you win.
For the upgrades, you mean?
Yeah. But it doesn't reset up until you lose, which is kind of like, oh, fuck. So now I'm in the middle of the strategy section. I think I have a few battles to do still to unlock the story. And I'm like, oh no, if I pick it up again, I will suck because it's been the months I've played this game, So I'll reset it. So I guess I will bite the bullet and just finish it. Those were maybe some of the moments this year when I was like, oh, it's been a while, I should go finish it because I really want to see the end of the story without being spoiled or just deciding to go watch it on YouTube, let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. That I'm like, oh yeah, but if I do that, that'll suck. So I think I will power through this in the coming weeks. It is a game I would like to pick up and finish during the holiday hiatus.
One thing I will add is if you do put the game down and you come back to it later, there is essentially like an entire in-game wiki kind of that explains literally everything you've seen in the game. So you can just read that and catch up pretty quickly. Of course, it's not going to tell you how to fight your battles effectively or what the skills do anymore. But at least for the narrative part of the game, there are no worries about putting it down and coming back a couple months later. Just before we go back to the no spoiler zone. I'm going to put two videos in the show notes if you want to hear more. I will put I think it was called like 13 Sentinels sales pitch or something like that, which was the video that I sent you that I told you watch this and you'll know what's up. Right. I will also put another video from the same podcaster, Wooly Versus, by the way, if you know him, from his playthrough, which is just a close up of the reactions to the bullshit in this game. Like there's no spoilers in the video. It's just a close up of the reaction on the webcam of them losing their shit every time something happens. And that's they said like they should make a commercial for the game, kind of like movie commercials for like horror movies where you see the people coming out of the theater, but it's just those reaction faces. Like, I think that's a great idea. So if you're not sold on it, go watch the reaction faces and then say, do you want to be one of those people? Because you should. Okay, so 3, 2, 1, we're back in the no spoiler zone. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about 13 Sentinels or we can go on to that?
Yes. Funnily enough, when you suggested and I watched a video that was part of the spoiler full section or spoiler some section, I should say, and I think it was maybe like during this moment of the year, like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, or like the Christmas/holiday deals you get on all the online stores. And I was like, I bought it on the PS4 because I didn't realize it was available on the Switch. And I, knowing it's not a graphic intensive game, I kind of wish I bought it on the Switch because
that's,
I felt
understandable.
It was more conducive to an NL console than sitting in front of the TV.
So, hilariously, this game was supposed to come out on PS Vita as well.
Really?
But the Sony discontinued the Vita before it came out.
Wow, that would have been amazing.
Yeah, well, I've played the late game battles, and I'm not sure the Vita could have handled it. What's hilarious, though, is that the same late game battles appear to run great on the Switch. So I don't know what they did, but it runs like shit on PS4, but it runs great on Switch. So magic, I guess.
Right. And related to that, it was available on the Switch, and I bought the PS4 version first. And of course, I was like, oh, when I figured out that, I'm sure it was not discounted on the Switch, because usually those discounts on the Nintendo store are less frequent, even if they're getting better at. But no, it was discounted. So yeah, I could have bought the Switch version. And I would say that if you're NL fans like Yannick and I are, I would suggest that you buy it on the Switch.
Yep, and it goes on sale a lot on PS4 and on Switch, so just keep an eye on your usual like Deku deals or whatever, or your websites where you track your deals, and you'll probably be able to snatch it up for not too much. All right, are we ready for number one?
Yes!
Okay, this game is a meme.
Is a meme?
It's definitely a meme. It's a game from last year, and it was definitely a meme. It's Stranger of Paradise Final Fantasy Origin. It was developed by Team Ninja, published by Square Enix. It was released last year on PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Xbox Series, and PC. And it's a fucking meme. Okay, so...
Okay, yeah, I think you have to explain it.
I will. But first, I need to actually give the serious explanation. Stranger of Paradise Final Fantasy Origin is a narrative prequel to Final Fantasy I. It was released as a celebration title for the 35th anniversary of the Final Fantasy series last year, and instead of being implemented as a typical Final Fantasy game as a turn-based RPG, it is instead very similar to Team Ninja's Neo series mechanically, which means it is a Souls-like action RPG with Diablo-style randomized loot and upgrade systems. So, lots of dopamine hits in this game. It's for crazy dopamine addicts like me. Ever since the first trailer came out, this game was a huge meme. And the reason for this is that the main character, Jack, is just some random ripped white guy with a smartphone that somehow ended up in a Final Fantasy game. And all he does is talk about how much he wants to kill Chaos, which makes no sense whatsoever. Sometimes he just walks away and starts listening to Limp Bizkit on his phone at the end of a cutscene. Sometimes he interrupts the boss introducing itself with, "I don't give a fuck who you are."
Wow. Okay.
He is basically me as a video game character. He is as disinterested in the ongoing story of the game as I normally am when I play narrative video games. And that is very entertaining to me.
Wow. But not to throw shade, but you're not ripped.
No, obviously not. No.
But for the rest, it's you. Okay, I got it.
Yes, he's completely disinterested by the narrative of this game. And... well, normally I would be, but this is so weird and funny and bad that it's actually hilarious to pay attention to the cutscenes in this game, so I don't mind. So here's the other reason it's a meme. If you're familiar at all with FF1's story, you will be able to see the punchline to the story coming from a million miles away. In fact, you could probably read the back of the box and guess what the ending is. It has absolutely no subtlety, and the only way you can't see it coming is if you know, like, literally zero about Final Fantasy I. And to illustrate this point, people already figured out what the ending of the game was immediately after the first announcement trailer and demo were released.
Really?
Square Enix had to scrap their entire marketing campaign, which revolved around the mystery of the ending of the game, and they had to rework it into something less stupid that sort of winked at the player that they already knew what the ending was. And that must have been very awkward for their marketing department, but it's also hilarious.
And for a noob like me that is about more or less the Final Fantasy game, as we've discussed when we reviewed in great length the first section of Final Fantasy VII, it was easy to guess because players have played FF1 and because it's a prequel, it makes sense that, okay, this will happen in this game, so that makes sense that the story of Final Fantasy I exists now.
I wasn't lying when I said the game has no subtlety at all. It tells you essentially in the first, like, two sentences what the ending is going to be. It's, like, very obvious if you know anything about Final Fantasy I.
Okay. Wow.
I mean, I don't actually want to spoil it, but...
No, that's fine.
It's really funny. No. It's just really funny. So the gameplay loop for this is your typical Souls-like kind of thing. So you progress through a dungeon, you reach orbs, which act as checkpoints, and when you die, you go back to them, and you lose whatever resources were attached to you. Your checkpoints are also the points where you can cash in whatever experience you have to level up, except in this game, you don't level up your character directly, you level up your jobs, which is part of the job system, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So you pick up your loot from your dead enemies and chests. This loot is tagged to have affinities for various character jobs, and each character in your party, including Jack, can be assigned to two jobs, which you can swap between at the touch of a button, which is really cool because you can have like magic skills and physical damage skills on the same character, which is really neat. The higher your items' affinities for your selected jobs are, the more job-specific passive bonuses you unlock. You gain MP gauge every time you damage enemies, and with that you can cast magic or use other higher power techniques, and all of these techniques are customizable and you can unlock different ones for your jobs, and it's just mechanical goodness. I love this shit. I love all of the... Give me all the systems. I want them. When your party members' MP gauges are full, you can order them to go all aggro on your enemies by pressing a direction on the D-pad so they can take the heat off of you. Much like in Sekiro and in Jedi Fallen Order, enemies have a regenerating break gauge, which goes down as you damage them, and some weapons will deal more break damage than raw damage. Once that break gauge is empty, you can unleash a one-hit kill attack by pressing circle in a given time window before the break bar goes back up. And this one-hit kill attack is one of the most viscerally satisfying experiences I have ever had in a video game, especially when you play it on a really good monitor with HDR and vibrant colors. Because when you press that circle button, Jack just grabs the enemy with his arm and just uses whatever fucking force magic he has and transforms this enemy into just a red crystal form, and then he immediately like dunks it to the ground and it shatters into a million pieces. And like this animation, I don't have words to describe what a dopamine hit it is. It is just so fucking satisfying, and you just want to smash things into the ground the entire game. And honestly, like the rest of the game could be shit. It's just this animation. It's so fucking good. It wins game of the year by itself. So yeah, obviously, like the rest of the game is super mechanically interesting, and like I expected this. It's essentially a Neo game with a Final Fantasy skin. Like I knew what I was getting into. I knew I was going to have a good time, but I wasn't expecting this fucking animation to carry the game to Game of the Year status all by itself. So if you listen to reviewers who actually played this game, they're gonna say like this is a 6 out of 10 game. It's not that great. It runs like shit on PS4. They're not wrong. But it's so fucking funny, and because the story is shit, and it's got such satisfying, weird system mechanics, and it's like a love letter to Final Fantasy. Every level is based on a different Final Fantasy game. So there's a map that's basically a map from Final Fantasy VII. There's one that's based on an actual dungeon from Final Fantasy XIV. In fact, I think they reused most of the assets for that thing. So it's very self-referential to the rest of the series, and if you're a fan of one or more Final Fantasy games, there are little things you're going to enjoy about this game, which is also just a great game with a wacky-ass story that makes no sense and the most satisfying video game animation of all time. So I do have some complaints, of course. It wouldn't be a me segment without some complaints.
It wouldn't be you at all.
Of course. So I like Souls-like games. I'm used to the difficulty of Souls-like games, which is to say they're usually quite brutal. I spent, no joke, 20 hours on the first boss of Nioh 1. I really fucking like that game, despite having spent 20 hours on the first boss of Nioh 1. So having said that, difficulty is a bit on the easy side for people who are used to playing full-fat Souls-like games. And this makes sense on paper, right? It's a Square Enix game, being a Final Fantasy series games. Especially the celebration game for the 35th anniversary, they want this shit to be playable by people who are used to playing RPGs with little to no execution requirements. So everyone who complains about Souls games not having difficulty settings, this is the game you have to go play, because it has difficulty settings, and the hardest one that is available on the default settings is too easy for me. Yeah.
Good brag from you, by the way, just saying. It's so humble. Oh, the difficult setting is too easy for me.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, yeah. The problem I have with it is that the description for the hardest difficulty at the start of the game is it's recommended for people familiar with action games. That doesn't sound like the text I want to read for the hardest difficulty, because I'm more than familiar with action games. I have played a lot of action games. I am bad at action games, but I'm familiar with action games. So the description isn't lying. It's just, it's not hard.
Right.
And up until 2/3 of the game, it was basically trivial. I could do whatever I want. Luckily, it's gotten a bit harder. And there are harder difficulties, but unfortunately, they're only available on repeat playthroughs. And I have too many games to play repeat playthroughs of video games. There are even harder difficulties available in DLC. I think there are like 9 difficulties in this game, if you count all of the DLC. But they only have the 3 at the start, and the 3rd one is too easy. So maybe just like add a 4th one and say, like, if you have played other Team Ninja games, or if you have played complicated action RPGs, play this and just have it be normal Souls difficulty and everyone will be happy. The game still rules anyway, and it makes me look, if it's easy, it means I get to do the fancy crystal smashing animation more, so maybe it works out. I don't know.
That's fair.
The other thing I want to mention is that this game is not a technical showpiece. I think it looks better than a lot of people say it does. I think the art direction in this game is really good. But it looks like a PS4 game on PS5. It looks like a PS3 game on PS4. And it also runs poorly on PS4. Same deal on the Xbox consoles. So, and the PC port is bad because it's a Koei Tecmo game that is ported to PC. And this is just how all of their games are on PC. So unless you are playing on PS5 or Xbox Series, I would not recommend this game. However, if you do have PS5 or Xbox Series, go have fun. This game is just a fun time, and it just has that satisfying crystal smashing energy for when you're really pissed off at everything that's going wrong in life. You can just go smash some enemies into crystal, and it's just so fucking satisfying. And it is so rare that I sit down to play a game and I feel like I was the target audience of one of this game. It's like made precisely for my brain worms. It's like, oh, they know exactly what kind of garbage I like, and they made precisely like this trough full of garbage for me to eat up. I love it. So yes, in this year, 2023, that has like 13 million 11 out of 10 games, I chose a 6 out of 10 game to be number one, and you can't stop me.
Because it's for people like you.
Yeah, it was designed for me. All right, so now that we've actually walked through these, first of all, it's going to be the shortest game of the year episode of all time.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. But I do want to look back a little bit at 2023, sort of... what I was planning on doing, sort of goals I had set and all of that stuff, and give a little preview of 2024. So the first thing I want to do, and I just remembered this, so I'm going to go check my website right now, is last year I mentioned a goal of mine, which was to play in a fighting game tournament every week for 2023, and I forgot to count how many I have. So luckily I have them all listed on my website. So I'm going to go count how many I have for 2023.
But you did do... a lot, but not every week, I guess?
Is that I played in 39 tournaments this year, and this does not count the month of November
Okay. Or
December yet. But yeah, so if you add,
yeah, let's so say let's remove 6 weeks.
Oh, yeah, okay. So like 45 tournaments in 2023 is still pretty good.
Yeah.
So the reason I was able to accomplish this is because, first of all, I went hard on other people's fighting game tournaments at the beginning of the year. And also because I have been organizing fighting game tournaments every week since February. So there is a Discord server I'm in with a bunch of friends. And we like fighting games, but we don't like fighting random people because they can be mean to you. So we decided to have our own fighting game tournament where we would just play against ourselves at games that we are all learning together. So we have this rotation of like, we have 3 regular games every month. So the first week is the first game, second week is the second game, etc. And then if there are any weeks left over in the month, we have wildcard games, which are randomly selected from a list of games that interest us. And we just play a different game every week, and we get good at 3 games at a time. And then every season, we reevaluate if we still want to be playing those games or swap them out for something else. So currently our games are King of Fighters 2003, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Guilty Gear, Double X, Accent Core Plus R, and then we have the wildcard slot, which is random with whatever games we want to play. So yeah, lots of fighting games in my life, and it's really cool. Like I mentioned last year, one of the things that I had liked about 2022 was that in the fall, I was participating in a Monday night tournament every week, and that meant that I actually had a reason to look forward to Mondays, and it kind of short-circuited my brain into actually thinking the Mondays were good. So naturally, I scheduled this tournament that I organize every Monday night because the Monday night tournament got canceled previously. So now I have a substitute for that, so the brain chemistry is back in the right place, and yeah, it's just fun to play with my friends every week, so that's cool. Another thing I wanted to do was slow down and play less games, and I did that, but I did not really succeed at getting any further in the games than I used to when I was playing more games, which is kind of a problem.
Okay, that sounds weird, yeah.
Yeah. Instead of playing the games for longer and to actually get further into it, what I would do is I would focus on the game for a couple days, and then I would just like not play for 3 weeks.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So I've been more absent. I've had longer periods of not really playing anything with a progression mechanic. Like I would always play fighting games every week anyway, but I have a hard time with game progression, and I think it kind of comes down to what I was saying with Donkey Kong Country 2. I think I am much more appreciative of games that have strong start and end segments. And when I play so many modern day games, I'm like, I don't know when this play session is going to end, so I can't start playing, which is really weird. I just feel like if I'm going to play a modern game that has no defined end segment, it's going to be like, I'm going to sit down if I only have multiple hours to devote to it. And a lot of the times I don't, so I just don't play. So there's weird hangups in my head going up around progression in video games. And maybe what I should have done for that is just played more PS1 games with levels and focus on that instead of PS5 in Switch games. But at the same time, I feel like I've spent so many years mostly focusing on PS1 games that I kind of want to play the stack of PS5 and Switch games I've amassed. So kind of in a weird catch-22, damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I'm not sure how I'm going to get out of that. Also, throughout the year, I've been watching a lot of videos about video game backlogs, because that is kind of the situation I'm in. And I sent you one last week when Daryl Talks Games actually did a two-year experiment, where last year's video was, I'm going to try to complete my backlog. And then this year's video was, I completed my backlog and I'm not really any happy about it. So like the entire psychology of how you manage your backlog and all of that is always super interesting to me. And I think like I have a way more complex and ridiculous system for managing my backlog than is warranted. And that kind of goes into my 2024 preview, which is I added a column to my spreadsheet for my backlog, which is priority, which is different from rating, because previously the only thing I had was I had unrated and I had rated 1 to 5. But just because I think a game is good does not mean I actively want to play it right now. So the priority field, first of all, includes games that are unrated. So it's like, how excited am I to play this game, regardless of whether it's actually good or not? And that means like, if I want to revisit a game that I rated a 4, because I'm more excited about that in the moment, I'll give it a higher priority, and then I'll sort by priority and I'll come out on top, and then I'll be more likely to play it. So like right now, my game selection technique, in giant air quotes, is sort by descending priority and then look at the estimated time remaining to beat and just choose things that seem manageable. And it's working surprisingly well. I've beaten a couple of games in the last few weeks just because I feel like just picking things off that seem like manageable tasks is a good strategy. So I don't know what that means for the 2024 overall list of games. Maybe I'll have more games beaten, but I will be happier with the time I spent on them. I don't know. We'll see.
It was funny when you sent me the video and I spent the... Like, this is a, I'm not sure if you'll include it in the show notes, but...
Yeah, sure.
Okay. But it is a lengthy one. I think it's
an hour long.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it goes over an hour, but it's like...
It's like 108, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Something like that. And it's funny also when you were just describing it, is that for a lot of nerds in general, and I compared it to developers that they ditch on Jira, it seems that a lot of nerds love to make quote-unquote Jira boards with priorities and then like having to groom your board and reprioritize things. It made me laugh so much and reminded me of work in a good, funny way when I was watching the video, and then he came to the realization that, yeah, it's good to have a backlog, and it's fine. Like that's life. Like, having things to do makes life fun. Completing all the fun stuff life can give you, including video games, that's kind of boring then, because you don't have any goals anymore. So I think it's finding the way to have an healthy backlog, and then like after watching this video, I was like, oh boy, it's so funny how I can think about ways of having like tech backlogs with bugs and tickets to do, and then just to be like, oh, okay, I see how you can apply that to your own backlog of tasks and of backlog of movies to watch, TV shows to watch, or even video games to play.
Oh yeah, we're not even talking about like, I have a project where I want to watch all of the Gundam series from the Universal Century timeline in chronological order. And like, that is going to be incredibly time consuming because there is a lot of UC Gundam stuff.
Oh boy.
And like, the TV Gundam seasons are like 50 episodes long because they're weekly for a year, right? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be fun. But let's not focus on that. One of the realizations I had also earlier this year is specifically about the production of this podcast, right? So I play games, I rate them, I put them in a list, I order them at the end of the year, like order them within their ranks. So it's less right. of an ordering task to do at the end of the year and having to remember like how I felt about those games. The problem is like a lot of the times I'll get to the middle of the year and I'm like, I'm pretty sure these top four are set for the rest of the year. So you feel like you can't really play anything that... Like, you're going to have too many honorable mentions that are, like, really good games if you do that. If you're like me and you're very, very selective about the games that you play, you sort of end up in a weird state where it's like, I really want to talk about this game, but it's not good enough to be in the top four. It's in six, but I'm not going to do, like, a top eight episode because it'll be 7 hours long.
Oi, you just bribe me to not play video games and then you'll be yet again another of your own topic.
I don't need to bribe you. You'll do that for free. But yeah, so there was this realization that like, if I do want to slow down and spend more time on each game, I can generally do that for the second half of the year and just like dump more hours into the games that are already at the top of the list.
Right. But I think you do have an assumption that the one you put priority on might be the best candidates to be part of your top four, which I think there might be surprises down the list. I'd be like, oh, you know what? I was not expecting this game, and that's because I played some of my top priority games that you could be gladly surprised, and I would bump up some of the games too without having to set them in stone, let's say in May in your gaming year.
I feel like that's where me and you kind of differ as like media evaluators, to use a very, very clinical term.
Right.
Which is like, because I don't really engage with narrative as much and I engage more with gameplay systems, like I know very well what gameplay systems I enjoy and what I appreciate about those systems. And like, unless the balancing is bad, the numbers balancing is bad, like I can go into a game and have a pretty good idea how I'm going to feel about that game at the end.
In my defense, your top one this year, you like it because of the fucking story.
No, it is one of the elements, but it would be on the list even if it didn't have the story. I would just say nothing about the story in that case.
Okay, I'll trust you, but still, I felt that that's an element that surprised you, that you liked it, and made and that's kind of how I interpreted it, is because of that surprise, which because you're not typically a narrative driven person in video games that it kind of surprised you and pushed you over to be like, oh yeah, no, it's even more of a reason.
But is it really a surprise when the first trailer of the game made it brutally obvious to everyone that this game is a giant meme? Like, it's not really an element of a surprise when it's literally in your starting trailer for the game.
Fair. But again, I think you're... all of this is, I think you're kind of boxing yourself here. I know we're not the same type of gamer. That I will never say that we are.
Well, like, but here's a sneak peek at next year, because I've already started playing games for next year's list, of course, is... Now Game Pass is in the equation, and Game Pass is interesting because the cost of trying things with Game Pass is essentially zero. Like, it's storage space on my Xbox, but it's essentially zero. I can take risks on games and not spend any money.
Oh, you're already spending that money, so the fact that you're trying it or not changes nothing in the equation.
Right. Okay. But, like, I would be paying for Xbox Live anyway just to play Halo Infinite Online or Forza Online, or just to have a copy of Forza Horizon 4 for free, right? So it's like, this machine, this Xbox Series S that I bought, it essentially exists only to exist as a Game Pass machine. I don't plan on buying any games explicitly for Xbox Series S unless there's an exclusive I can't get somehow, but that seems against the business goals of Microsoft, to be honest. Or unless something is like heavily discounted on Xbox and it's not on PS or whatever. So that means like I can play games that I am uncertain about without spending any money with basically zero friction. I can just queue up the download on my phone and it's already there when I get in my bed, right?
Right.
And I have done that for a few games, especially shorter games, like games that I know are under 7 hours. Like, fuck it. I'll just install it and play it and see how I feel about it. And I think mainly the surprises that I'm going to have are going to come from randomly trying short shit from Game Pass. But the main list of stuff that I want to play is just going to be like stuff I have spent money on that I wouldn't have spent money on unless I already knew it was going to be something I was going to be fairly interested in. Like, there's a reason the majority of my ratings for my games are 4 out of 5. Because I typically don't buy things I know are going to be rated a 2 at the end of the year.
Which I agree with you. Like, when you mentioned rating, it kind of made less sense because, like, if you don't think the game is going to be good, why buy it, right?
Or
why
it can still disappoint you, right? So Gran Turismo 7 was a 3 for me.
Yes. No, I get that. At that point, when you rate the game, the only way is down, sadly.
Yeah, or like I played a bunch of NES games through the Switch online thing, and some of them are very primitive and boring, and I rated them a 2, right? So it's like, it's not impossible to get there, but the chance that I will spend money on games to be disappointed is essentially zero, because I know what I'm buying ahead of time, because I literally spend all my day watching videos about video games. I think I know what's going on in them.
No, exactly. That's literally throwing money out the window. Like, if you know that the game, you won't like it. Like,
and like the other thing I would add to that is, generally when I put games on my wish list, because we have a family wish list for birthdays and Christmas and all of that stuff, when I push games on my wish list, they are generally not games that I'm actually thinking about buying, because first of all, like, around Christmas time and all of that stuff, I don't want to see a good deal on a game and then not be able to buy it. Or if I'm excited about the game, I'm probably just going to buy it and not wait for someone to give it to me. But if there are things that I'm like, I'm not convinced about this, I'll put them on my list. And then sometimes I get a pleasant surprise at Christmas where it's like, I got this game that I wasn't sure about, and it turns out it's actually really good. So there are still, like, ways to introduce unknown quantities into my system. It's just they are not super frequent.
Ah, okay. Then that makes sense of what you were saying when I was saying, like, yeah, you're not leaving room to experiment. But it seems that your wishlist system for like family gifts of people they don't know what to buy you, and also a good justification of going to the Microsoft gaming system with the Game Pass is the other part of that strategy.
I do the same thing with PS Plus as well. Like, I look at the monthly games every month. Right. I still only redeem things that I think look interesting, But a lot of the times I redeem things, I'm more permissive in what I'll redeem anyway, because some things can just stand out. Like, for example, the Hot Wheels, there was a Hot Wheels game that came out last year. I don't remember what the exact name is. I think it's Hot Wheels Unleashed. Like, the reviews for that were really, really good, but I'm not going to spend like $70 on a Hot Wheels game. But I got it for free with PS Plus.
Right.
So like I was able to take that, and I haven't played it yet, but I probably will eventually, maybe in a couple weeks, who knows. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are still ways to introduce like random shit into my system. Like, don't worry. And I watch enough reviews for weird random games that nobody's heard of that, like, if I see something that interests me that is not heard of, I will still add it to my list. I know what my taste is, and I'm not going to waste my time on a game that I know is not for me.
Oh, that's fair. We can talk for the next 3 hours about not waste time on hobbies, for sure.
So I guess I want to close this out with talking through your PS5 process, your justification. Like, I understand, like, you're not excited about anything, and I think it's a very hard generation to be excited about because so much shit is cross-gen still.
Yeah, but even then, okay, I think the best example, like, if you in the end Tony decided to buy it still, was the Hogwarts Legacy game, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people saying, I'm not bringing anything of the moral of buying the game in this episode. I'm just talking about the tech spec of it, which was mm-hmm. most people saying, like, this game is pretty nice, technically speaking, and it is worth playing. I forgot if it's on PC. I think so, but for sure on the PS5 or the equivalent Xbox Series X. I forgot which the naming.
Series X, yes.
Yes, okay. But they're worth playing on the current generation console. I was like, you know what? I don't know, at some point in the next few years, I would like to buy a PS5. Like I mentioned last time I said that, I wish I was planning to say, hey, for this generation of console, I won't do like I've done with the PS5, the PS4, excuse me, which was wait 2 years after the launch. Guess what? We're more or less, we're more than 2 years after launch.
More than 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't bought one. So, but you're correct that compared to the PS4 where I felt, I'll say late to the game, you're correct that this time around, as not being a PC gamer too much, will ignore my, I guess, adultery. Like, I don't know how to make it as a funny imagery more than that with gaming on the Mac and with Farming Simulator. But I'm generally speaking a console gamer because I don't want to buy a PC. But it's interesting that I think... Okay, I'm not trying to push more work on you, but if I reflect on the past few years, I've seen that the games I've played are recommendations from people I trust, right? Mm-hmm. Farming Simulator, I knew what Farming Simulator was, but my brother was like, no, it's fun. Like, you should try it for reals. The same thing you did for 13 Centennials. Like, trust me, you should try this game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's that part that I'm missing. Again, Tony also has a few Switch games that is like, you should play. But maybe if I were to think about 2024, if I want to play a bit more, if I want to stay into the comfort zone of, let's say, 4 or 5 games per year without not investing like $200 again on a video game, and be able to at least do 4 or 5 games in that same time slot, let's put it this way, I need to possibly find a way or be a bit more upfront with friends saying, hey, you play more video games than I do. Do you have recommendations of new games or even just old games you've played recently that you know what type of game range I like and things like that? Like that will be well worth my time. And I think that's kind of what I've realized too at the end of this episode, is I didn't put myself into those situations, nor did I consume content to put myself into those situations compared to the previous year. And I guess it explains why I don't feel really motivated to get a PS5, nor to play other games.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's also really funny. I kind of alluded to it earlier in the ending of the the Stranger of Paradise section, which is, this year, if you listen to the mainstream gaming media, is one of the most stacked years in gaming history for, like, game of the year material games. Baldur's Gate 3 just came out of nowhere and just reset expectations for what a video game should be.
All the Zelda people getting out of the world say, like, the new Zelda is, like, amazing. Again, it's even better than Breath of the Wild and blah, blah, blah. So
I've been saying for years they do that every fucking time.
I'm good to see that discourse in the next few weeks.
I've actually seen more negative pushback for Tears of the Kingdom than I've ever seen for any Zelda games, but spoilers. So
interesting to see that in the Game of the Year videos of the next few weeks.
Yeah, there was Spider-Man 2, which I don't want to start the debate, but that is one of the most questioned Game of the Year entries this year. I think most people have said it doesn't do enough that's different from Spider-Man 1 to warrant being on the list, even though they sort of also say, yeah, but Spider-Man 1 is also a really good game, though. So it's
right, and you don't have this kind of newness feeling regarding a new game. If they kind of more or less reuse the same.
There are some questionable design decisions in the game as well that sort of distract from the Spider-Man fantasy, but that's getting into mechanical specifics and stuff like that.
I see.
What other games are there? I'm going to go look at the Game Awards, which is something I never do. It's like there's so much shit that came out this year that I can't remember all of it.
Yeah, but you mentioned Baldur's Gate, which I've heard. Even me, I have heard about it, and a lot of people.
Alan Wake 2 is on this list, which that's debatable. Resident Evil 4 Remake is on here. I think that's justified. Super Mario Brothers Wonder, yeah, that's on here. That's kind of justified.
Yeah, which and we, well, Zelda. I say we, but Tony bought, so. I know. Oh, I forgot to mention, I didn't play it, but a game that I think was on your list either last year or 2 years ago, Captain Toad.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a game that Tony bought recently that I was eager to try too. Didn't do it, but I guess it's on the list now, or the unofficial list.
But it's really funny for me that, like, in a year that is so stacked in modern releases, and that only counts the ones that are, like, quote unquote 11 out of 10 status. there have been so many things this year, and yet I couldn't bring myself to care about most of them. I only tangentially care a little bit about Baldur's Gate just because of the weird side marketing with Magic the Gathering, where there was a Baldur's Gate set last year. So I'm tangentially aware of the characters and all of that stuff from Magic cards. So I'm like, oh, okay. But, like, knowing me, I would probably want to go start with Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 because they're the retro games, and older games are better games. Everyone knows that. So, I just find it funny that someone in my position who is very into following games has not played any of the big games. And I think, like, the biggest game I played this year was, there was a weekend demo of Diablo 4. Which I could play on Game Pass, and I played that for a couple hours, and then my demo expired because the weekend was over. So, like, that is the only game from 2023 I've played all year. Well, Forza, but technically that's next year. Anyway, no reason to drag this on any longer. Thanks for listening to the Game of the Year episode. I told people to write in and tell us their Game of the Year, and surprise, surprise, I forgot to copy and paste your messages into my document, so I don't have them in front of me.
Oh, so I guess we'll have it for our last episode of this year in 2 weeks as a follow-up. So
yes, thanks to all of the nice people who wrote in. There were more people than usual, which is why it's even more damning that I forgot to write them in my document.
Oh, that's okay. That's why we have follow-up.
Yep.
Good. You'll be able to find all the show notes for this episode, including all the top four games that Tinnik has mentioned and some of the videos we've mentioned, at limitlesspossibility.net/218, so 218. You can find our complete back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at @limipo_podcast, @Mastodon Social. You can find us individually there too. I am at Luco at Mastodon.social, and you can find Yannick at
Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks for our last episode of 2023.
See you in 2 weeks.